Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the May 12th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is 12 Migrants Sharing a Queen's Apartment by Jordan Salamana. A reporter at large, 12 migrants sharing a Queen's apartment. In New York City, a shadow economy helps new arrivals find a place to sleep. Sometimes it's just a bed and a curtain, by Jordan Salama. In my neighborhood, everyone knows the corners where migrants wait for work. I live in Jackson Heights, Queens, where you can't so much as step out the door without hearing a language other than English. Newcomers arrive in waves and settle like layers of sediment. On my block, there's a contingent of elderly Polish ladies who have been living in their century-old co-ops for decades. A few blocks over, in one direction, is Calle Colombia, the official nickname for a corner of 82nd Street since 2009. Countless times I've walked past a street vendor guarding tall stalks of sugarcane that she feeds through a machine to make juice. A few blocks over, the other way, Bangladeshi men, their beards dyed orange, hawk prayer rugs and other religious goods from overturned milk crates on the sidewalk. In recent years, the newest residents have come mostly from Venezuela, Colombia, and Ecuador. Such migrants line up each day at dawn at paradas, stops, hoping to get picked up for day jobs like tiling, roofing, or painting. At least among Spanish speakers, paradas across New York are known by names that describe either their location or their purpose, such as La de Limpieza, the house cleaning one, or Home Depot. How these spring up is less complicated than one might think. People learn to do whatever work is immediately available in the area. The main house cleaning parada is in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where women regularly find jobs in the homes of Hasidic Jews. In the leafy suburbs, there are more landscapers. In Flushing, close to a blocks-long stretch of Chinese-run kitchen and bathroom showrooms, there's a street corner where the waiting Chinese men know how to install kitchens and bathrooms. These word-of-mouth spots exist all over the city and the surrounding suburbs, but nowhere are they more crowded than in Queens. The most popular construction parada near my apartment is technically in Woodside. La 69 is a section of 69th Street between Roosevelt Avenue and Broadway. For years, it was normal to see a few dozen men milling around there, but since 2022, hundreds of workers have been lining up in the mornings, including more women than ever. In the winter, nonprofits and church groups hand out jackets and hot breakfasts, and during the warmer months, at one end of La 69, some people sleep in a tiny plaza called Pigeon Paradise. Earlier this year, after the Trump administration took power and began what it called the largest deportation effort in the U.S. history, the numbers lessened for a while. People are terrified of ICE. A regular told me that at least twice an unmarked car pulled up to the parada, sending everyone running. But attendance at the parada has since returned to pre-Trump levels, despite the obvious risk. People have to work. At La 69, there's hardly a system, but people are known to wait in certain areas according to their nationality. Mexicans and Guatemalans near the plaza, Ecuadorians and Colombians closer to Roosevelt Avenue. This could be because contractors prefer workers who hail from their home countries. One day last summer, a car pulled up to La 69. It was 10 a.m., which is around the time when people at the parada who haven't been picked up yet think about going home. A crowd of Central Americans who were still waiting by Pigeon Paradise sized up the car as it slowed to a stop. When they realized that this meant a potential job, they swarmed. More than 20 men tapped on the windshield and called out day rates in Spanish. 150, 140, 120. One man agreed on a rate and jumped in. Please, the other men pleaded, as they do every day, just take one more. Don't worry too much about that, one day worker said in Spanish as he took his seat and cracked open a can of Coke. He went by Peto, And he was 27. I've been here 8 years, but it's never been as bad as this, he said. There were just too many migrants, Peto said, and not enough jobs. Guys would work for anything nowadays. We went to an apartment building nearby where Peto spent several hours unscrewing shelves, pulling down old paneling, and organizing piles of debris. During a lunch break, Peto called his family back home. His parents still lived where he'd grown up in the mountainous region of Chilatenango, Guatemala. He spoke with them in Quetzal, his first language. Later, Peto told me that he was building a home there with the money he'd earned here. Not even renovating, from scratch, he said. Construction was coming along, and he hoped that in 2 or 3 years it might be ready, and that he could go back to finally start a family. I'll have my little house and my little land, he said. Now that's what you'd call a dream. Here, there's no life, only work. He shook his head. Work every day for 8 years. As Peto kept on through the afternoon, he told me that he lived in a shared house in Corona, some 40 blocks from La 69, with other migrants from Guatemala, Mexico, and Ecuador. He considered himself lucky. You can never be entirely sure about living with anyone beside your own family, he said, but he got along fairly well with the other tenants. I'd heard about migrant houses like the one Peto described. Jackson Heights, Corona, and Elmhurst are full of them. You can identify them in many cases from the black garbage bags of personal belongings that have been stuffed onto metal balconies for lack of interior space. These dwellings range from crowded but legitimate sublets to dangerous and unlawful boarding houses. At worst, they resemble modern-day tenements, entire families crammed into single bedrooms with any common spaces subdivided by curtains or sheets or partition walls to allow for as many additional beds as possible. They are often dark, cramped, and poorly ventilated, with barely any privacy. When the pandemic began, it quickly became clear which New York neighborhoods suffered the most from overcrowding because of their overwhelmingly high rates of infection. Central Queens became known as the epicenter of the epicenter. In 2021, during Hurricane Ida, 10 people living in unregulated basement apartments drowned in floodwaters. Last month, 3 men died when a fire broke out in an overcrowded home in Jamaica Estates, where immigrant tenants lived. According to reports, the landlord lived in the back of the house and had long been renting out beds in small makeshift rooms divided by partition walls. Migrants in New York also whisper about an even cheaper arrangement, renting beds by the hour, alternating with others on a schedule. This is sometimes known in Spanish as a cama caliente because the bed is still warm when a night shift worker comes home in the morning to sleep. In February, I paid a portion of one migrant's rent for a bed in a 2-family row house in East Elmhurst. I came and went as I pleased. 12 migrants, all from Ecuador, lived on the first floor. The housemates told me that another large group lived on the second floor, though they weren't allowed upstairs and rarely spoke with their neighbors. The house's owners, an older woman and her adult son, lived in the basement. The first floor had 4 bedrooms, each occupied by a young couple paying $800 to $1,100 a month. One of the couples shared their room with their 5-year-old daughter, the only child in the house, and her uncle. In the narrow hallway, brown and red shower curtains cordoned off a 5th room that had twin beds, about $700 each, placed so close together that they were almost touching. 2 single men slept there. Each shared a tiny bathroom, where a handwritten sign over the toilet read in Spanish, "Gentlemen, aim well into this bowl, thank you." A small kitchen was the sole common area. On one side, there were stained wood cabinets, sticky from years of grease. Along the other wall stretched a peeling bar counter with 3 chairs. There wasn't enough space in the fridge and the cabinets for a dozen people's food, so a lot of it stayed out in the open. On the bar counter sat 3 giant plastic tubs of rice. In some cupboards, unrefrigerated leftovers such as grilled fish or cooked rice speckled with peas and carrots were kept in covered pots and pans. Large bags of sugar sat unsealed on the tile floor, where cockroaches scurried around day and night. On a freezing afternoon in mid-February, the entire house reeked of nail polish remover. I entered the kitchen to find one of the residents, Leela, getting a manicure. Supplies were strewn across the counter: brushes, cotton balls, bottles of acetone, various colors of polish. Two of Leela's housemates, Elisa and Mercy, were doing the nail painting, one woman on each hand. "We didn't find work at the Parada today, so we're doing this," Mercy told me in Spanish, without taking her eyes off the smooth coat of violet polish she was applying. "We have to pass the time somehow." "Have fun," I said tentatively. Leela, a 26-year-old, had long black hair and wore a t-shirt printed with the word Hatteras, the North Carolina beach town. She'd never been there. She had an air of confidence that set her apart from the other housemates. She slipped more English words into her Spanish sentences, even if incorrectly, and she'd been in the country for a year or two longer than most of the others. I was impressed that she had enlisted the two women to work feverishly on her nails. For a moment, I wondered if Leela might actually be paying them. Then I realized that whenever Elisa or Mercy finished a coat, they immediately scrubbed off the polish with acetone and started again. This was a training session. "I work in a spa, and the girls are hoping to get jobs there this summer," Leela explained. "I'm teaching them." Besides Leela, the other housemates worked in construction. Those who lacked regular work set out for the Paradas each morning before dawn. All the tenants were young, mostly between 24 and 30, and over time they'd learned certain skills. Elisa and Mercy were mainly plumbers. Elisa's husband, Ivan, and her brother, Matias, were mostly roofers. Others described themselves as jacks of all trades, capable of doing everything from house painting to sheetrock installation. Leela's husband, Adolfo, placed himself in this category. "Anything to renovate a home. That's what I know how to do." A housemate named Anita had recently been finding work in the parking lot of Home Depot in the Bronx. This led some of the others to start looking for gigs there too. This past winter, the housemates seldom went out. Day jobs were scarce and it was too cold for volleyball and soccer, their favorite pastimes. Perhaps more important, the Trump administration had them terrified. Nobody had any kind of legal status, although some of them personally knew anyone who had been deported. Rumors of mass arrests were enough to restrict their behavior. Throughout January and February, the neighborhood streets were hushed, the Latin American restaurants emptier. Even before Trump's inauguration, a city campaign named Operation Restore Roosevelt had forced the removal of many unlicensed street vendors from the area, compounding the eerie quiet. "We just stay at home," Matias told me. They passed the time in their bedrooms, where they ate most of their meals and scrolled TikTok or watched TV. A bilingual sign hanging in the front entrance read, "Notice, door must remain locked at all times." Even Yuri, Mercy's 5-year-old, played mainly inside now, running in and out of the room that she shared with her parents and her uncle. On the day of the nail painting marathon, Elisa and Mercy kept at it until well after dark, becoming dizzy from the pungent chemical odor that hung in the stale kitchen air. When they finally stopped, Leela's cuticles were stained black. All over Queens, especially along major thoroughfares such as Roosevelt Avenue, posters in Spanish affixed to lampposts, walls, and train pilings advertised rooms and apartments meant for migrants. "I rent an apartment, 4 bedrooms, available now. Living room, kitchen, bathroom, 7 to 8 people. I rent rooms, Veronica, no papers, kitchen okay." Some signs taped over another specify if rooms are exclusively for women or couples and if children are allowed. In recent years, real estate agents and landlords have begun posting versions of these signs on Facebook groups and TikTok accounts, accompanied by photographs of bare mattresses and empty rooms. Migrants try to avoid real estate agents, who typically charge 3 times 1 month's rent for the first payment, and landlords who require documentation, especially income verification. It's illegal in New York City for landlords to require proof of immigration status when selecting tenants. Among migrants who post online in search of housing, one of the most common phrases is "no real state." The best way to find housing, everyone said, is to hunt with people you already know. Plenty of migrants have no choice but to depend on the ads. I recently came across a Facebook page called Quitaras Onranta, Queens, New York. An affiliated website advertised apartments and single rooms for sublet in Queens. I messaged a number on WhatsApp and soon began texting with a broker named Renata, who wrote to me in Spanish in all caps and immediately began trying to persuade me to rent a room in a shared apartment in Woodside, two blocks from the 7 train. "They are asking what you do for work and what country you are from," Renata texted. "Just like some of the contractors hiring day workers, people frequently prefer to live with housemates from their own countries. Migrant communities in Queens have their own prejudices and stereotypes about one another. I've learned that many Ecuadorians think that Mexicans are drunks and Venezuelans are criminals. Mexicans and Guatemalans, in turn, often think of Ecuadorians as vagrants." In the days and weeks that followed, Renata sent me photographs of small but neat-looking bedrooms across central Queens, mainly in Jackson Heights, Elmhurst, and Woodside. If I didn't respond instantly, she called and texted multiple times. "You don't answer," she wrote. Finally, one night, we spoke on the phone. Renata told me that for her clients, the ideal roommate spends most of his time out of the house and doesn't cook much. Derroches a la Cochina, rights to the kitchen are a negotiated amenity in a shared house. You pay lower rent if you eat all your meals elsewhere. In New York, one of the most expensive rental markets in the U.S., the reason for sharing a space with so many others are almost always financial. Non-immigrants in New York may not understand how widespread and varied these arrangements are, especially in the outer boroughs. I met a Peruvian couple who were renting out their second bedroom, originally meant for their baby, to a single man. I visited a Mexican family in their Corona apartment, where a young relative who was new to the city slept on the couch. Jenny, an Ecuadorian woman living in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, told me that 10 people were staying in her three-bedroom apartment. The landlord had recently raised the rent because of the number of tenants, Jenny told me, but otherwise didn't bother them. A landlord who allows overcrowding can be subject to fines, but the penalties per violation are relatively low. Plenty of these roommates' arrangements are cordial. Everyone living at Jenny's place ate dinner together at night. "There's one gentleman from El Salvador living with us, and he's gotten used to Ecuadorian food," she said, adding that she sometimes lets fresh arrivals sleep in the living room for free. Nevertheless, living in such tight quarters with so many other people can create severe tensions, particularly when everyone's financial condition is precarious. Emperitriz Carpio, who manages the domestic violence program at Voces Latinas, a nonprofit that serves migrants in the Jackson Heights area, told me that some of her most complicated cases arise in shared living spaces where victims lack the financial stability to move out. "I had one client who had been experiencing emotional and psychological abuse, and she still lived in the same house with her ex and his new partner," Carpio said. "I believe the house had three rooms. She was in one room with her two kids, and the ex and his new partner were in another room. Eventually, the new partner also brought her family into the third room. The client mostly just stayed in her own room." Alcohol abuse, Carpio added, was another common problem. "I thought of Pato, the Guatemalan man I'd met at La 69. After that work was done, he offered to return the next day with a companion to help haul out debris that he'd arranged in dusty heaps. The following afternoon, Pato showed up with one of his housemates, Maria, a short Ecuadorian woman who wore leggings and a long-sleeved shirt. "Don't worry, she's strong," Pato grinned, and Maria nodded. "Works harder than any man I've seen. She's the strongest woman in Ecuador." For the next 2 hours, they trudged up and down three flights of stairs, lugging hundreds of pounds of trash. Maria lifted the heaviest loads, navigating the stairs in determined silence. Later on, the drive back from the dump, the strongest woman in Ecuador spoke about the three children she'd left behind more than a year earlier in a coastal community overrun by drug cartels. "I'm doing this for them," Maria said. Pato opened his backpack and began drinking from a tall can in a brown paper bag. "I smelled beer." He spoke longingly about Guatemala and the home he was building there. I eventually learned that, however lucky Pato felt about his housing situation in Corona, his housemates saw things differently. Not long after the dump run, his phone number went out of service, and Maria told me that she and the other tenants had kicked Pato out because he was drinking too much. When I finally tracked him down 6 months later, he told me only that he'd had personal problems and was now living in another shared house in Elmhurst. I tried on several occasions to meet him again, but he always canceled. He sometimes called me randomly. Twice he rang me in the middle of the night. One morning at 10, I answered, and Pato's speech was so slurred that I could hardly understand him. The owners of properties where new migrants live are often immigrants themselves. Having arrived in New York a few decades earlier, perhaps from China, Ecuador, or the Dominican Republic, they settled in Queens and eventually achieved homeownership. Some, such as the owners of the East Elmhurst House, live in the basement, maximizing their own margins by renting the upper floors and minimizing liability by likewise living in the shadows. Other property owners rent out multiple units and reside elsewhere. In New York State, such people are known as small landlords, which means that they own no more than 10 units. Many are middle class and view their rentals as necessary to offset high living costs. From public records, I learned that the landlords of one crowded Corona migrant house, some of whose renters I've known for a while, owned at least four other properties across Queens and the Bronx. I couldn't reach him directly, but one of his tenants told me that he was kind. He went by Jack, but she referred to him as El Chino. "El Chino treats us well," she told me. "When he comes to the house, he asks us what's bad, what's not bad, and he fixes things. At Christmas, he gives us a toy to each of the kids." Jack spoke only Chinese and English, she said, so her eldest daughter, who was 11, translated his instructions: how to put the bottles where the bottles go, the plastic where the plastic goes, the cardboard where it's cardboard, the food where it's food. The tenant added that her daughter has a protocol for translating. "Mamie, first I'll listen and then I'll talk," the girl likes to say. Small landlords often know about overcrowding or other irregularities in their units, but they tend to ignore such matters as long as the rent is paid on time. Sometimes they just want to avoid conflict. Roy Ho, the president of the Property Owners Association of Greater New York, an organization that he founded in 2020 to support Chinese small landlords, told me, "Landlords are aware that this problem exists. They trade stories. Their tenants might come in and say, 'I'm renting for me, my wife, and my kid.' Then 2 months later, they go to fix the water or the plumbing and realize it's so many more people. Attempting to resolve the issue in court is a long, costly process that can end up being more of a financial risk than accommodating such renters. They are reluctant to address the problem, even if they want to," Ho said. Hoya Chen, a 41-year-old hospital worker based in Bayside, Queens, manages a two-family rental property in Maysbeth for his elderly parents. He told me, "We were tenants ourselves in the beginning. After the family of four moved to New York City from Fujian, China in 2001, they shared a cramped one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan's Chinatown for nearly 7 years. We were never late paying rent," he said. "My parents worked super hard, and they encouraged us to finish school. Luckily, my sister and I were able to go to college." In 2008, during the housing bubble, Chen's parents bought the house in Maysbeth for $928,000. To afford the mortgage, they rented out the second unit to the employees of a company based in Poland. 9 years later, they moved into a five-bedroom house in Bayside, along with Hong Yo, his wife, and his children, and started renting out the entire Maysmith property to supplement their monthly Social Security income of about $800. Chen told me that he and other small landlords he knew used to be quite content to accept tenants on the margins of the economy. Some people maybe had a cash job or didn't have a stable job, but we had no problem renting to them, he said. Chen also acknowledged that it was a common practice to rent out basement apartments at lower rates, mainly to undocumented tenants. Small landlords often considered undocumented renters to be among the most reliable tenants because they don't want to attract any legal trouble. I know landlords who prefer undocumented tenants for this reason, Ho said. The renters may not have a pay stub, but you know they will pay on time. For Chen's family, everything changed during the pandemic. In New York State, eviction moratoriums lasted until early 2022. And in 2024, the state passed the Good Cause Eviction Law, which solidified eviction protections for renters. At the time, Chen's father, who speaks no English, was still in charge of managing the Maysmith property. He got scammed by a real estate agent, hung out, Chen said. The agent, who he says was unlicensed, presented false proof of income documents, saying that a man would occupy a three-bedroom unit with his wife and two children. Nine people ended up living there, and they all stopped paying rent after the first month. They slept in the living room, everywhere, Chen said. The utility bills were extremely high. Chen felt that he had no recourse but to contact the police. The tenants eventually left. My parents are talking about to transfer the ownership to me, Chen texted me recently. But I don't want it. I hate being a landlord. That is more than a full-time job and too much problem to be a landlord in NYC now. One day I want to sell it. Life is too short. I want a peaceful life. Chen's sister, who is now married, at one point owned two rental properties of her own on Staten Island. She has since sold them, he said. Such stories led Ho, a small landlord himself, to found his group as a way of organizing Chinese landlords in the city. Asian households have the highest rate of home ownership in New York City, partly because in immigrant communities there can be a lack of knowledge about securities, such as stocks and bonds. A dearth of legal status can sometimes make utilizing such options difficult. They may have a nail salon, a restaurant, retail, even a cash business, and a 401k is not accessible to them, Ho told me. Real estate is one of the only assets that they understand. Several activist groups in the Asian American community have since embraced the landlord's cause as part of organizing campaigns that often include unrelated issues popular with conservatives, such as opposition to affirmative action in college admissions. Ho told me the impression that you get is that Chinese landlords have become more vocal than they used to be, and they have become more vocal than other ethnic landlords. He said that in New York, the issue was a major driver of the community's rightward shift in recent elections. The resentments of immigrant landlords illustrates a broader paradox of current city politics. Older immigrant communities, often inherently sympathetic to the challenges faced by new arrivals, are increasingly voting for politicians who espouse broadly anti-immigrant policies. Thomas Yu, the executive director of Asian Americans for Equality, a community development organization with an office in Jackson Heights, told me, "There's a lot of anger at the city for how they feel like the legislators have left them behind." For more than 20 years, Yu has been looking to find solutions that work for both landlords and tenants in the immigrant neighborhoods. In 2022, his group launched a pilot project providing grants for small landlords to renovate their units, thus allowing them to participate in a federal program in which tenants experiencing homelessness or abuse pay part of their rent with vouchers. Although federal housing vouchers are generally unavailable to undocumented tenants, a new bill that has been introduced in the legislature in Albany would establish a housing subsidy program for all renters across New York State, regardless of their immigration status. You're listening to the New Yorker Magazine. read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, on Sun Sounds of Arizona. You found that, especially in the outer boroughs, small landlords were eager to accept the grants. They needed that economic stability for themselves, he said. There's a sort of dogma in this world that all landlords are bad and that all tenants are free from fault. It's very hard for people to be nuanced about it. He worries that the pressures on small landlords will have a long-term impact on what he calls New York's cultural enclaves, neighborhoods such as Jackson Heights, Chinatown, and the Lower East Side. It forces a lot of these small owners to cash out. They're like, I give up. I cannot sustain this. So they sell to bigger and bigger and fewer property owners. All the immigrant homeowners I spoke with emphasized that they did not want to make things harder for new migrants, but they insisted that the current system is failing, making it more difficult for small landlords to turn a profit and for tenants to find decent, affordable housing. An Iranian-American landlord whose family, seeking asylum during the Iran-Iraq War, brought him to New York as an infant, told me, people have to do what they can to get by, just like my family did when we came to America. Today, he manages 6 rental units in Queens. He lives in the basement of one of his multifamily properties in Astoria, where he has noticed issues of overcrowding in other homes nearby, including one multifamily dwelling that seems to house a phalanx of delivery drivers who speed around the neighborhood on electric scooters. I'm not here to pull up the ladder after making it off the lifeboat, he noted in an email. Still, it's tough to see how this plays out for landlords and neighbors. Leila and Elisa, two of the Ecuadorians in the East Elmhurst unit, are sisters-in-law. In 2023, they were living together with their husbands in a smaller Corona apartment when they learned that a group of relatives was headed to the U.S. border. The two women set out to find a bigger place where all of them could live. After work, they knocked on the doors of local houses that had for rent signs in the windows. They found the East Elmhurst house after a few weeks. They didn't know how to check the Department of Buildings website, where they would have learned that there were no certificates of occupancy registered for the property, and that there had been numerous complaints filed over the past 10 years alluding to overcrowding and illegal conversions. One complaint filed in 2015 reads, "The house is subdivided in many rooms and is renting the rooms like a hotel." The place was certainly tight, but the housemates were glad to keep costs down, even if it meant piling up on top of one another. Over time, more family members and friends arrived from Ecuador and occupied the remaining rooms. The two couples had learned some useful lessons in their first apartment together, where the landlord had lived in the same unit and enforced strict rules about kitchen rights and cleaning responsibilities. "It's not good to live with strangers," Lila's husband, Adolfo, told me. There were small things that they came to like about the new house, such as its proximity to a bus that took them to the Parada La 69. Between the house and a neighboring one, there was a light well, and the housemates realized that in the winter, they could use it as a second refrigerator, storing cartons of milk on the windowsill. They set house rules. No outside shoes were allowed indoors. Everyone wore black Nike or Adidas slides inside, or, in Mercy's case, fluffy teddy bear-like slippers. Every day, a housemate was assigned to clean the kitchen and the bathroom and to empty the garbage. They called one another neighbor and soon gave out nicknames. Adolfo, who constantly used sad face emojis in the house group chat, was Tricito. Eduardo was lean and strong, and he wore tight-fitting shirts that showed off his muscles, so his nickname was Musculo. The house's eldest resident, a 37-year-old single man named Efer, liked to play soccer, so he was called Messi. But for the most part, the house was uncomfortable. The absence of privacy was maddening, and the tenants were constantly smashing the cockroaches in the kitchen with their slides. "We have to live like this," Matias told me. "This is the reality of being a migrant." Everyone had kitchen rights, 11 adults and one 4-burner stove, and this meant that they cooked meals and shifts beginning at 3 a.m. One of the residents had heard that New York City tap water was unsafe to drink, so for nearly 2 years, they had needlessly bought cases of plastic water bottles from a market down the street. Frustratingly, the house came unfurnished. On Junction Boulevard, the tenants found the basics, mattresses, bed frames, kitchenware, but the items cost them a relative fortune. They learned to be wary of Facebook Marketplace, where sellers frequently asked for payment up front, then disappeared. They were surprised that things like that happened in America. The tenants began to trust only one another as they established a routine that marked the beginning of their American dream. We talked a lot about dreams during the days I spent there. Most of the housemates had left everything behind. Some had parted with their kids without knowing them, or if they would see them again. Some wanted to leave the U.S. as soon as they had enough money to take substantial savings back with them. A few were considering staying for good. Mercy, whose daughter barely remembered Ecuador, said, "Ultimately, God will decide." One day in the kitchen, the tenants discussed the infamous case of a social media personality who'd offered to help transport the body of a dead migrant back to Ecuador and then allegedly ran off with all the money. I told the residents that a business near my apartment offered a similar service, funeral transports to Latin American countries. They looked horrified, and I sensed the years flashing before their eyes. Since they'd come to New York, many of their dreams had begun to feel more abstract as they focused on the day-to-day difficulties of surviving. Muscula still had a vision, though. He wanted to become a licensed plumber so that he could start his own business and work for himself. Some friends had recommended a vocational school in New Jersey, but the tuition, about $4,000, was prohibitive. Mercy, his wife, told me that she was hoping to find an affordable after-school program for Yuri when she enrolled in kindergarten. Currently, the couple was paying $200 a week for daycare. Mercy didn't realize that many public schools in the cities provide after-school care for free. All Matias wanted was to get a tax ID number so that he could find a regular job and stop waiting for contractors at the Parada every day at dawn. He was trying to figure out how to do the necessary paperwork. Lila was determined to learn enough English to be able to communicate with her clients at the spa. Indeed, all the housemates had the goal of mastering basic English. Some showed me notebooks that they had filled up at free classes around the city. Lila told me that she had trekked all the way to Long Island City for her first such class. Inside the notebooks, they had carefully written out Spanish phrases and their English equivalents, translated phonetically so they could more easily pronounce the words. Un more time, please, for one more time, please. See you tomorrow for see you tomorrow. But for the most part, they had found these classes boring and far too advanced. They needed to focus on the basics. I, you, we, and the essentials. Room, bed, job. The few words they already knew were trade-related. Roofing, plumbing, nails. Sometimes late at night in the kitchen, when the housemates had returned from work or from looking for work and were cooking in shifts, two people at a time using the four burners, reheating rabbit or potato stew, they asked me to hold casual English lessons. They wanted to learn how to ask very specific questions. Matias's request, will you pay me now or later? Mercy's, why are you discounting more from my paycheck than from hers? The only person who understood everything I said was Yuri, Mercy's daughter. But the five-year-old, like so many immigrant children her age, was too shy to speak English in front of her parents. One of the adults, Leila, was the most engaged student. She said that her bosses at the spa spoke mainly Korean, but some English, and that she would be grateful for any chance to communicate with them, even if her own English were limited to halting sentences. After a few days of lessons, she coined my house nickname. I became prof, as in teacher. A prize ribbon sticker, the kind that kids get for winning first or second place in a school competition, was stuck to the door of the bedroom where Anita slept with her husband, Hernan. I did my best, it read. Yuri must have received the award at daycare, I figure, unless it was a trace from previous tenants. The housemates didn't know anything about the prior resident. A migrant dwelling doesn't tend to break up all at once, unless something happens with the landlord, an eviction notice, say, or the sale of a property. More often, people gradually trickle out, their rooms or beds given to new occupants, until the home's population looks nothing like it did a year or two earlier. A tenant could become financially secure enough to rent on their own, or a job offer could lead them to another city or state. Perhaps, as with Pato, a dispute or vice churns up enough trouble to warrant a less amicable departure. Now another possibility loomed large. ICE might pick someone up at work and they never be heard from again. Even though the East Elmhurst housemates lived in such intimate quarters and some of them had been well acquainted back home, they kept a great deal from one another, especially when it came to matters such as money and their plans for the future. Why were some of the housemates unsure about exactly how much the group paid in total rent? Adolfo collected the money individually at the start of each month. At one point, Matias mentioned to me that he might be moving to another state. Through some contacts from Law 69, he'd heard about a potential long-term job at a building in Kansas, or maybe it was Minnesota. It would be for 2 years, wherever it was, he told me. When I brought this up in the presence of some of the other housemates, he winced. I didn't tell them, he revealed afterwards. The out-of-state opportunity fizzled, but Matias still contemplated leaving and finding a proper room that he could have to himself, instead of paying some $700 a month to sleep in a bed inches from another tenant. He began an active search in mid-March after his roommate, Messi, drank too much one Saturday morning and caused an altercation, breaking the front door of the house before passing out in his bed. A housemate called the police, but the officers didn't come inside. Messi ended up paying about $1,000 to repair the door. As with every dispute in the house, alliances formed over whether to kick Messi out. Some were vocal about wanting to expel him. Mercy, for her part, was upset that the incident happened while Yuri's cousin was visiting. The little girls had been scared. To my surprise, Matias was more willing to let Messi try to redeem himself. He noted that he and Messi had both left their wives and kids behind when they came to New York. I understand that people are lonely. I really get it, Matias told me. I thought again of Pato, the Guatemalan migrant whose own removal had seemingly led him to spiral, and considered how lonely he must have been, too. Living with many others was no antidote to emotional solitude. Things blew over and Messi stayed. Still, Matias said the episode had made him intent on improving his own situation. He called numbers he'd seen on for rent signs and was considering some rooms a few blocks away. The only thing stopping him from moving out was that he didn't want to leave his sister Elisa, the only family member he had nearby. It's a very, very difficult decision, he told me. I'm thinking about it a lot. As Matias considered his options, spring nudged Queens back to life, even if many people remain fearful of the intensifying deportation efforts. People have been flocking back to 34th Avenue, the longest pedestrian street in the city. Children play in the shade of budding oak trees, and women from Mexico and Ecuador ring handbells and scoop ice cream from red carts. The remaining members of the neighborhood's old Argentine and Uruguayan communities, who were prominent here before they moved out to the suburbs, share sips of mate on park benches. A group of older Bangladeshi and Nepalese residents gather for tea. In the evenings, an elderly husband and wife from Eastern Europe, who must be in their 90s, are wheeled out by their Caribbean aides to watch people stroll by. I've never seen the couple say a word to each other, but sometimes his finger grazes the side of her hand, and staring straight ahead, she smiles. Everything in New York City is touched and shaped by these waves of people, not only those who came earlier, but those who continue to arrive now. The idea of making it in the new country is inextricably linked by memories of the old country and those who remain there. In Queens, it's virtually never a mistake to ask someone where they are originally from. People's eyes will widen with the happiness or with sadness, depending on how long they've been away, but always with longing. Everyone has their own way to cope, Matthias told me in late March in Corona. I play volleyball. He led me to three houses on the same block whose residents had constructed elaborate volleyball courts in their backyards, complete with spectator bleachers, floodlights, and tall mesh fences around the court's perimeters. At least one of the homes had been a volleyball house for more than 20 years, I learned, and had hosted generations of Ecuadorian and other Latin American migrants who gathered to play or watch anytime the weather was good. The people who lived here worked the courts, renting them out. Elderly Spanish-speaking women grilled chicken and pork off to the side, which they served in abundant portions alongside potatoes and rice. Others sold hot and cold beverages and loose cigarettes or worked as referees. The matches continued into the night, even when gusts of wind left us shivering in our windbreakers. The most competitive courts had dozens of onlookers. There, Matthias and I ran into familiar faces. Ivan, Hernan, and even Messi also hung out at the volleyball houses. The others, they told us, were still at work. By Jordan Salama. Jordan is the author of Strangers in the Desert, a family story. Around City Hall, why can't New York have nice mayors? As the Trump administration encroaches on the city, Andrew Cuomo and Eric Adams try to salvage their political careers. By Eric Locke. On Easter Sunday, the choir at Calvary Baptist Church in South Jamaica, Queens, was finishing warm-ups when Cara, Mariah, and Michaela Kennedy Cuomo, the daughters of Andrew Cuomo, the former New York governor, walked into the sanctuary. The three young women, dressed in white, nodded serenely at the congregants, exchanging good mornings with black men and women in their Easter best. A few minutes later, Cuomo himself appeared, looking smaller and grayer than he did when he was in office. He was quickly enveloped in a swarm of church hats. For the next half an hour, the ex-governor clapped, sang along to hymns, and swayed his shoulders, framed by a banner that proclaimed, "He is risen indeed." The public hasn't seen much of Cuomo since the summer of 2021, when a report from the state attorney general's office revealed that nearly a dozen women had accused him of sexual harassment, and he resigned from the governorship in disgrace. Cuomo had subjected New York's political class to a decade of vicious bullying. He once screamed, "I will destroy you," on a phone call to an assemblyman who was drying a bath for his daughters and faced impeachment if he didn't leave by choice. After his resignation, it felt like a pall had been lifted from the Capitol building when state senator recalled. Yet somehow, not 4 years later, Cuomo is the front runner to be the next mayor of New York City. At Calvary Baptist, the pastor, Victor Hall, revisited the high point of Cuomo's career, the early weeks of the pandemic when he became a national figure by holding daily press conferences that distinguished him as a stern, fatherly foil to the conspiracy-addled president. His lilting Queens accent and snug polo shirts inspired the term Cuomosexual. Less than a year before he was ousted, some Democrats called for Cuomo to replace Joe Biden on the presidential ticket. "My family in Texas during COVID watched Andrew Cuomo every day," Hall told the congregation. When Cuomo got up to speak, he offered a bit of fan service, beginning his remarks with an extended ribbing of his son-in-law, who was known as the boyfriend during the pandemic pressers. "We got off to a rocky start early on," the former governor said, to knowing laughter in the crowd. Eventually, Cuomo got to the day's main theme, which was comeback stories. He read dutifully from Bible passages that evoked humanity's need for salvation, the creases in his forehead scrunching like an accordion when he was especially animated. "They will rebuild the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated. They will renew the ruined cities," he said, quoting briskly from the book of Isaiah. New York City, in his telling, was itself a devastated place, too unaffordable, too crime-ridden, too prone to division. "To be honest, this city needs work," Cuomo said. "Today we celebrate the power of resurrection. On those last two points, at least everyone could say amen. When Cuomo stepped down, he was technically homeless. In his third term, the governor's mansion was his only permanent address. He crashed with his sister Maria at her estate in Westchester and filled his days with extracurriculars that evinced a desire to return to public life. Private legal work, a straight-talking political podcast, the emphatically named nonprofit Never Again Now, which was meant to combat anti-Semitism. 3 decades ago, his father, Mario Cuomo, earned the nickname Hamlet on the Hudson for his tortured deliberations about whether to run for president. The younger Cuomo's style has always been more Richard III. Cuomo found his opening last September when Eric Adams, the mayor of New York City, was indicted on federal corruption charges. To establish residency in the city, he commandeered a midtown apartment where his 30-year-old daughter, Cara, had been living. He may have cribbed the move from Adams, who in the last election was suspected of trying to pass off his son's Brooklyn apartment as his own. His old allies from Albany formed a super PAC and swiftly began collecting checks from New York's elite. Cuomo made overtures to black clergy, to the city's most influential unions, to staunchly pro-Israeli Jewish voters. Political figures such as Representative Richie Torres of the Bronx endorsed Cuomo before he officially announced that he was running, as if moved by the spirit. "We need Mr. Tough Guy," Torres said. For most of the campaign, Cuomo has scrupulously avoided his opponents, the press, and open-air public events, an approach that's been described as a Rose Garden strategy. "He's a terrible campaigner," a former aide told me. "We saw this in the polling. When people saw Andrew, they didn't like him." Still, an aura of inevitability has hardened around Cuomo, whose opponents include Zoran Mamdani, a 33-year-old Democratic Socialist state assemblyman, a handful of progressives mired in the single digits in polls, and Adams, who has lately courted the favor of Donald Trump to avoid possible jail time. Perhaps the city's current crises, crumbling public infrastructure, intractable civic strife, the president's attempts to strangle his hometown, have reminded New Yorkers of a different period of chaos when Cuomo seemed a beacon of sanity. After being cheered off the stage at Calvary Baptist, the ex-governor herded his daughters into the backseat of his black Dodge Charger. As he ducked behind the wheel, he cracked the smallest of smiles. For every Fiorella LaGuardia or Michael Bloomberg, there are dozens of forgettable and ignominious characters in New York's mayoral lineage. Nicholas Bayard, the city's 16th mayor, had ties to the slave trade and was an associate of the pirate Captain Kidd. David Matthews, who served from 1776 to 1783, was an anti-revolutionary loyalist who was implicated in a plot to kidnap George Washington. Jimmy Walker, the charismatic crooked nightmare, who took office in the Roaring Twenties, came closer than any before him to being removed from office by a governor and evaded criminal corruption charges by taking a steamer to Europe. Rudy Giuliani, who was once considered a national hero for his leadership during 9/11, and who went down in a spray of legal and financial troubles after tying himself to Trump, arguably represents a third category of mayors who are both ignoble and indelible. Eric Adams seems destined to join him there. At the start of his tenure, Adams declared that he would be a mayor with swagger. He became a fixture of exclusive nightclubs and doled out cushy positions to old friends from the NYPD and the Brooklyn Democratic Party. Mayors usually have one guy or two, a former senior official in the Adams administration told me recently. Adams had 12 guys. There were so many of them, they were bumping into each other. When the federal corruption charges against him were unsealed, they seemed so inevitable as to be underwhelming. The case focused on campaign donations, discounted air travel, and other freebies accepted from representatives of the Turkish government, allegedly in exchange for favors like fast-tracking the opening of a new Turkish consulate building, the kind of petty deal-making that Tammany Hall bosses once approvingly called honest graft. But the indictment gave way to something much worse, the mayor's cozying up to Trump. The courtship spilled into a public view in October at the Al Smith Dinner, an annual white tie fundraiser for Catholic charities. During Trump's remarks, he made an overture to Adams, a fellow criminal defendant. "I was persecuted, and so are you, Eric." An awkward flirtation ensued. Adams, who during Trump's first term called the president an idiot, hired the celebrity lawyer, Alex Spiro, who has represented Elon Musk for his defense. After Trump won the presidential election, the mayor called to congratulate him. Later at a meeting, he told the city's senior agency heads to refrain from criticizing the president-elect. Surreal, one attendee said. When Trump was asked if he would consider giving Adams a pardon, he appeared to consider the question for 2 seconds before saying, "Yeah, I would." In January, Frank Carone, an ex-Marine and longtime Brooklyn power broker who had served as Adams City Hall chief of staff, coordinated with Eric Trump, the president's second son, to arrange a meeting between the mayor and the soon-to-be reinstalled president. Over lunch at Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach, the two men found what Carone, who joined them at the table, described to me as pleasant surprises of commonality. But Carone vigorously dispelled any notion of an arrangement between Adams and Trump. "I'll give you the facts, reality," he said. "There was no discussion with President Trump about his case or about immigration or any deal whatsoever." Maybe there didn't need to be a discussion. 3 days later, on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Adams ditched local civil rights commemorations to attend Trump's inauguration in Washington. Just a few weeks after that, ML Bove, a senior official in Trump's Justice Department, asked the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan to put Adams' case on hold, arguing that the charges were interfering with the mayor's ability to help enforce White House immigration policies. And that's all we have time for today. By Eric Locke. Eric is a staff writer, has contributed to the magazine since 2008. He writes regularly about New York City politics, people, and more. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.